Thank you, Jamie. All right, if you guys aren't aware of this yet, my name is Tim, and I'm an addict. Good morning. I'm glad you guys could all make it. This is my first actual 12-step recovery speaking in people before. I have given my testimony in front of my church and in front of other people that have known me a while longer. I'm really grateful to be here. I'm very thankful, especially to this meeting, which I consider my home group and call my home group. It, like Jamie had mentioned, the growth that she has seen, a lot of it was due to this meeting and getting involved with the people at the meeting. I'll kind of get more into that as we go on. I am definitely a person who believes in the power of prayer, so I would like to open this with a prayer, and if all you guys would not mind just a moment of silence and joining me as I say this prayer. I'd like to say a prayer for those who truly seek recovery, that another person carrying their message will be able to connect and spark a flame inside of someone struggling, that will light a flame that burns to help changing a life of suffering into a life of happiness. Amen. All right. Hope, faith, and courage. Three main words that I've come to really appreciate in life. You know, three words of emphasis in this program. There's a couple other words that have meant a lot to me in this program. Honesty being a big one. Willingness being another big one. Accountability. Acceptance. Surrender. As I kind of share with you guys today, you'll see how I struggled with a lot of that, and then how, you know, through working these steps and working this program and reaching out to others and listening to others has really humbled me and allowed me to grow and gain a better understanding of those words, because I feel that I'll continue to learn what those words mean as long as I continue to keep doing the next right thing and take it one day at a time and let my higher power stay in the driver's seat, you know, and allow God to do his will in my life instead of me trying to play God, basically. That's the bottom line. Real quick before I start with my life, I'm just going to go over this too. Currently, I'm about a week away from 2.5 years of continuous sobriety. This is the third time since I have started sobriety that I have reached a 2-year milestone, I guess I'll call it. So I'm really, really working hard to gain, you know, that 3-year chip for the first time. As I go through my story, I'll explain too, but usually recovery goals for me has been able to straighten out some of the thoughts that I've had when I'm feeling weak and when I consider or contemplate using again or picking up again. A lot of the times it's goals like that that are really the most powerful from keeping me from making those bad choices. I do have other siblings. I have an older brother, an older sister, and a younger brother. Growing up for me was maybe the typical or average life of a kid growing up in the suburbs of Milwaukee. I grew up in New Berlin. My mom raised our family in a Lutheran church. I would attend church for Sunday school, and I would attend church Sundays after church. Our family would go and have a brunch with my maternal grandfather and grandmother. They lived just a few miles up the road on the same road that we lived on, so Sundays was always a pretty big event, and church was always, you know, kind of a main staple in our lives. Growing up as a kid, I can remember being real young. My mom and dad, on the surface, seemed fairly happy. My dad traveled a lot. He made more money when he was on the road, so my dad was gone a lot. So my mom pretty much raised us four kids. people that know me know that I tend to be a busybody. I was totally the same way when I was a kid. I was never really around. I can remember as growing up, when people would meet other siblings, I was always the last person they would meet because I was just never around. I was always out doing something. I've heard some people speak about, I don't know, having a foggy childhood or whatever. I can remember my childhood from a pretty young age. For the longest time, I can remember going to 3 preschools. The first preschool I went to, I was 4. The second one I went to when I was 5. And then I had to do a preschool for a third time because my birthday is the cutoff date for school, which is September 1st. So since my birthday was the cutoff date, they wouldn't let me start school on that day. So I had to kind of start school a year late. And I was one of the oldest people in my grade, which was kind of neat for when I turned 16 and one of the first people to have my license. And then I was 18 for my senior year of high school. And there's kind of some advantages that go along to having, you know, that as well. One of the first things that kind of really had an impact on my life was when I was 8 years old. There was a fire in our house. Lightning struck our house, somehow zapped through some wires, and there was a fire that started in our basement. There was a lot of damage to our house. And the reason I'm bringing this up and mentioning it is because shortly thereafter, I believe I was about 8 years old, I was at that point in time sexually abused by my sister for a few years. And it was, I don't think somebody at that young of an age really understands what's going on or how inappropriate it is and, really knows what to do or say about being in a situation like that. And you guys are probably like the third group maybe that I've mentioned it to. I'll kind of get into that more when I actually finally came to terms with it and talked about it and opened up about it and first started sharing about that. But that was probably one of the first things, you know, that really kind of impacted my life. And I didn't even realize how much of impact on my life it had till many years after that. I am one of those people that has very vivid dreams, like every single night. I actually have a dream journal where I log, and there's many nights where I'll log like 3 or 4 dreams, and it's pretty crazy. So needless to say, like having something like that happen to me as a child caused for a lot of subconscious discomfort. You know, it definitely made for some pretty outlandish, crazy, you know, subconscious thoughts. I got my first job before I was 15 years old. I grew up in New Berlin, like I said, and I saw a lot of kids with a lot of things that I wanted, and my parents just weren't able to accommodate me in my selfish ways. So I was told that if I wanted nicer things, like nice shoes or nice clothes or something like that, then I would have to earn my own money. So I got my first job when I was 15. I'm going to backtrack just a little bit to the age of 12 because that's when I was first introduced to drugs and alcohol. I started smoking pot at the age of 12. I pretty much didn't stop smoking pot till sometime in my 30s. We used to, you know, steal liquor from parents' cabinets and stuff like that and drink on occasion. When I was 12 also, my parents basically separated. My mom and dad were really at each other's wits' end, and my mom decided that she was going to move out and leave the house. She stayed with her parents that were not too far down the road, and I moved out with my mom. I just couldn't see my mom being by herself. And that definitely created some conflict between my siblings and myself. My siblings were saying that I was wrong, my mom was wrong, and there was just a lot of conflict there. One of the huge advantages of doing that was my best friend lived, not even an eighth of a mile down the road. You know, and that's a lot of where our pot smoking and drinking took place. His parents used to leave frequently on the weekends, and we would raid their dresser drawers and find pot, and we would get stoned, and we would take, you know, their liquor. And, a lot of crazy, wild stuff started happening for me right around the age of 13, right when middle school started. A lot of the drugs and alcohol and girls and all that kind of stuff. But back to my first job, I started making money when I was a little bit before I was 15. Shortly thereafter, I started selling drugs to get more money. I can remember being at a Christmas party for that first job I had, and pretty much everybody that I worked with was adults. And one of the guys that worked in the kitchen wanted to go outside and get stoned. And so we were out in his car getting stoned, and I was 15 years old. I didn't even have a license. And everybody else kept coming out to the car, and nobody could believe that, you know, all the pot we were smoking was mine, you know, some 15-year-old kid. You know, it, like, that to me kind of appealed, you know what I mean? Like, being so young and just kind of like having all these adults come out and think that that was kind of cool. Like I said, all through high school, I definitely sold a lot of drugs. When I graduated high school, I had more money in my bank account than what my parents had. I can remember being 18 years old, and if my parents were low on money and needed cash, they would borrow it from me. You know, because basically I had a full-time job all through high school. So all of my drug dealing money was the money that I spent, and all the money that I made from work would be saved up. High school was pretty crazy. I played sports 3 out of the 4 seasons. I graduated on the honor roll. All of my friends in high school did a lot of drugs and drank. I've had numerous coaches tell me that I was hanging out with the wrong people. And I kind of learned a lot about the political ways of the world by being who I thought I wanted to be and then having all these other people who I felt were judging me for the way I was living and then telling me what they thought they knew what was best for me. A large majority of my friends dropped out of high school between 10th and 11th grade. I actually graduated high school with one friend in my closer inner circle. He actually ended up being my roommate at college. Starting in middle school, I went to a school where it was middle school and high school combined, and it made for a lot of turbulence. I was back in middle school, I mean, real early 90s, and I lived in the suburbs, and I listened to rap music and hip-hop music, and back then, it wasn't popular. It was definitely... I definitely got into a lot of trouble because of the way that I was discriminated against for being a white kid, wearing Jordans, maybe having pants that were too big, wearing athletic clothing, listening to rap music. Basically, my whole middle school and high school was a lot of fights. We got into fights everywhere we went. I saw a lot of violence growing up as a kid. Just ugly stuff, you know? Just for an example, I mean, we used to expect fights, so we kind of knew it was going to happen. So we would have, you know, we'd be in like a group of like 20 to 30 people. And for instance, one year we were at like Western Days or whatever the heck it's called in West Dallas, and it was pretty much all country Western people. And of course they wanted to pick fights. And of course they're all adults, you know, and we're just like 15, 16-year-old kids. And I mean, I can remember leaving there when we got into a fight outside of there. There's a guy laying in a puddle of his own blood convulsing, you know, and that was pretty much the regular. That was pretty much the usual. We, like, didn't see anything wrong with it. I mean, they're the ones who are picking on us and starting the fight with us, and they're adults. So we justified it by beat them up, you know. There was a lot of that. A lot of that at house parties, a lot of that pretty much wherever we went. I mean, I'm pretty sure we were like 14, 15 years old when we, you know, started drinking malt liquor. And of course, like I said, we were all selling drugs. So we all had money and we, you know, were smoking a lot of pot. I also did a lot of mushrooms when I was in high school. I don't know. It was crazy. Like I said, my best friend that lived up the block from my grandma, he sold a lot of pot. So we could just go into the refrigerator in the basement and there would be pounds of marijuana in there, you know? So, you know, we would just kind of, whatever, have people over after school, especially girls, and kind of take advantage of that whole situation. And as far as the fights were concerned, too, there was a lot of those in school. Like, when we were in middle school, there was a lot of high school girls that were interested in hanging out with us because of the way we were doing. And a lot of the high school guys didn't like that. You know, it kind of started with, like, the freshman girls, and then eventually it worked up with some of the junior and senior girls that were hanging out with us. We were in middle school, and a lot of the guys didn't like that. By the time I was a sophomore in high school, not much of this had changed. And some of the older people, I mean, just really started to get blatant and do some crazy things in school. So, I mean, we would get into big fights right in the hallways of school. And eventually some of the older people kind of started, like, having enough of that. And some of the older people started getting involved. And they kind of set some of those other guys straight. You know, and that was kind of a feeling of acceptance among other people, too, outside of just our small group. You know, so I can remember how good that felt when somebody else was willing to stand up for us and who we were and just being the way we are. So I went to college for a little while, still definitely selling a lot of drugs. I kind of got talked into the whole college thing. Like I said, when I graduated high school, I'd saved up a whole bunch of money. I'd basically saved up like $14,000, which was enough money for me to pay for 2 years of college. My parents, there was nobody else in my family that had been to college. There was definitely not going to be anybody in my family that was going to go to college. So my parents were encouraging me to go to college. I started dating a college girl when I was a junior in high school. So, of course, she wanted me to go to college. The guidance counselor was encouraging me to go to college. I personally wanted to take 1 year off of school so that way I could save up the rest of the money that I would need to pay for all 4 years of college. But yet all these people that are encouraging me were not going to be able to help or willing to help me pay for college. But I ended up doing it, and I ended up doing 2 years at Whitewater. And after that 2 years, I was out of money. And I just didn't see the appeal in going into debt, you know, graduating from college, not knowing if I was going to be able to get a job, seeing people graduating from college with, like, double majors, and yet they're working the same jobs as my friends that dropped out of high school in, like, 10th and 11th grade. That just didn't appeal. I mean, I don't know. So I stopped going to college. After college, things really actually got amped up. I started to take time off from responsibilities. You know, I was making so much money that, and just partying so much that there was no real appeal to having a job. I mean, it would just get in the way. One of my suppliers would drive up from Cicero, Illinois, and I was buying quite a bit from him. And at the time, he was telling me, you know, if I wanted to make real money, what I needed to do is start selling cocaine. You know, he would have cocaine or kilos of cocaine in his trunk. And he was trying to convince me to start selling that. And I had kind of seen a little bit of what was going on in people's lives that were doing cocaine at the time. And I had never really seen addiction or experienced addiction in my life, you know. Like, I didn't really see how it affected families or see how it affected an individual. I guess my paternal grandmother was a bit of a prescription drug addict and an alcoholic. And then from what I understand, my dad's brother has been struggling with drug addiction his whole life since he came back from Vietnam. But I've only met my father's side of the family twice in my whole life. I think the last time I seen him, I was 10 years old. You know, my paternal grandmother and grandfather have passed away by now. So I had never really seen how it impacts someone's life. You know, I didn't really know how devastating it could be. But I knew it wasn't good. So I didn't really want to get involved with something like that at the time. I would just continue, you know, to sell mushrooms and marijuana. But after a few years of living pretty crazy, you know, things for me kind of started taking a turn when I started getting into the rave scene. I was living at a house in Waukesha for about 2 years. The guy that I rented from was a Pewaukee police officer. And yet I lived in his property for 2 years, never with a job, always paying him cash. So I can't really imagine what really he was thinking. I lived with four people that were going to Carroll College at the time. I started going to rave parties probably about two or three times a week for a few years. I can remember getting put on probation in like 2001 for my first DUI and possession of cocaine. At that time, I was kind of dabbling, not really using. And I went to court and I was put on probation. And my friends picked me up from the courthouse and we drove to a rave in Indiana the day I was put on probation. So needless to say, that first time I was put on probation, I didn't really do anything that I was told I needed to do. I started getting into ecstasy, LSD, ketamine, morphine, all kinds of crazy drugs, all kinds of crazy hallucinogenics. shortly thereafter, I don't think there was a drug I haven't tried. Any kind of prescription medication, you know, everything from, like I said, fentanyl, morphine, Dilaudid, any kind of opiate, pretty much. Crystal meth, you know, eventually I got myself a pretty bad Oxycontin addiction. I went to detox for that for a while, and I don't know, it was pretty bad, you know, like everything got to the point where life was spinning out of control. I'm going to kind of jump to where things met ahead and then get into the solution, because I know I've been speaking for a while. So things got so bad one time that I decided pretty much that I didn't want to live anymore. And so my plan was to get some money, break into my dad's house. The reason I wanted to break into my dad's house is because I knew he had a lot of guns and he had a gun safe. And the whole intention of breaking into my dad's house was to steal a gun. That way I could get high for, whatever, 2 or 3 days and then end my life. You know, like that was the whole intention. That was the whole purpose in breaking into his house. I broke into his house. I was probably searching for a little less than an hour trying to find the key to the gun safe, and I couldn't find it. And eventually, you know, it just gotten to be too much time, so I took what I could and I got out of there. I was probably on my third day of getting high or something like that. I was at a friend's house, and we heard some noise out in her backyard. It was like November, but it was so warm out that we had the windows open. And I heard some noise going on in her backyard, and I kind of knew it was the cops right away. I ran down into her garage, and for some reason, her garage locked from the inside of the garage. So I was able to lock myself in the garage. About 10 minutes before that happened, I had shot up too much coke, and I was overdosing to the point where I couldn't speak. I really couldn't breathe. I was having a hard time struggling and communicating. I was just kind of focusing on trying to stay alive at the time. And then the cops broke in. So I went down into her garage, and I sniffed like the last few bags of heroin I had. And then when the cops were telling me to turn myself in, you know, I just had these crazy ideas of like running on the hood of the car and jumping through the window and trying to make a run from the cops. But I didn't. I was so messed up at the time when they were patting me down. You know, they asked me if I had anything in my pockets. I wasn't sure. So they searched me. When I got to the police station, they turned my pockets inside out, and I had tin foils of heroin residue, or I had residue on tin foils. So since I was in the police station, I was convicted of felony possession of a narcotic. I also got a felony burglary charge from breaking into my dad's house. I was put on probation. That's kind of when I first started giving recovery a little bit of a chance. I was clean and sober for a while. Almost, I think it was right a little bit over 2 years. I had started doing, no, I wasn't doing NA at that time. I think I was just pretty much, whatever, jumping around from program to program at that time. And then, as you can see, like, that's kind of when life started getting crazy, you know, like, I have an obituary here for he was my best friend at the time. His name was Corey. I really kind of started to isolate at this time. I didn't really want to be around people that were using or partying, so I kept myself to a small group of people. I can remember being at our friend Brett's house when Corey and his girlfriend walked into the bathroom together, and then they came out, and he said that his girlfriend was pregnant. Almost 9 months later, Corey, like, within those next 9 months, Corey was definitely starting to change. We all had, like, everybody I was hanging out with at the time had bad Oxycontin addictions. He had started a methadone treatment program. His mom came downstairs one morning and found him purple, and he had died. He had smoked some crack, and the combination between the methadone and the crack had killed him. That was my first friend that I had pass away due to drugs. I wish I would have brought Marshall's obituary with me, too. In 2007, I had two of my best friends die a week apart. The first one to pass away was Ross. He was really, 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 really struggling with heroin at the time. And he was a pilot. He had his pilot's license. He hadn't been flying for a while, which was good, because he never used to fly when he was getting high. I got a call from his mom, I think the Friday before Christmas. And I can remember thinking how foggy it was, because it was warm. And I was like, man, I'm so glad that Ross hasn't been flying because this is not the type of weather you want to be flying in. I got a call from his mom. She asked me if I knew where he was. I said no. I got a call from her the next day, and she said that he stole his dad's airplane, flew somebody up somewhere to go make some money, and on the way back his plane crashed and he died. I don't want to assume, but life was really bad. His parents had given him an alternative to, you know, get some treatment and straighten out his life. Otherwise, they were going to commit him. I had just introduced my friend Josh to my other best friend, Ross. They hit it off real good. They started hanging out, being buddies. Josh was in Arizona for Christmas visiting his dad. He came back. I had worked with Josh. When he came back, you know, I told him about Ross passing away. Josh called me up the Saturday before New Year's, same weekend I was at Ross's funeral, and asked me if I wanted some drugs, some heroin. And I didn't answer the call. I knew that's what he was calling about. And I didn't answer the call, and I was still pretty distraught from going through everything I was going through with Ross, and I was still shooting up a lot of drugs at the time. And then my best friend Josh died from a heroin overdose the very next weekend. So I went to a funeral pretty much the weekend of Christmas and the weekend of New Year's for two of my best friends that died. Gonna kind of skip to my other friend, Marshall, who just died a little less than 3 months ago. Same thing, heroin overdose. You know, it's sad. It's sad, and for a little while it kind of makes me angry. But I'm gonna jump back now, you know, and kind of touch on the whole thing about me wanting to kill myself and treatment. So eventually, actually the year after these two passed away on Christmas Day, I overdosed while driving a car from heroin. I was sent to prison. I did a treatment program in prison, a challenge incarceration program. I was doing a lot of treatment there, and that's the first time that I opened up and shared about the sexual abuse from my sister. There was an 18-year-old guy in our group, and he was a foster kid, and he had talked about the sexual abuse that he had gone through. And I couldn't believe the courage that this 18-year-old kid had to share something like that. So that's the first time I opened up and shared about the sexual abuse, you know, that I had experienced. There was a family visit day, and my mom came up, and I sat there with the lady who did the therapy. And I talked to my mom about this, you know, and I had mentioned it to her. And you know, like, my mom looked sad or whatever, but basically she just kind of shook it off. But then the topic also came up about me breaking into my dad's house, you know, and trying to find a gun. And my mom told me then, which was almost like 3 years later, that my brother told her that he had a bad feeling that morning before he went to work, and that he took the keys for the gun safe to work with him. So they weren't in the house, and that's why I didn't find it. That's why I couldn't find the keys for the gun safe. So, you know, like, the whole spiritual awakening that's talked about in this program kind of, like, took on, I don't know, a lot of weight that day when I'm talking about this stuff. You know, I get out of that program. I'm clean and sober for about 2 years. I get into a relationship. It was a relationship with somebody I work with. She was separated from her husband for like a year and a half. They were going through a divorce. It kind of started out as a slow relationship, but before I knew it, I'm like living with this woman. And I told her how much disappointment I was feeling over the way that we were living, and technically she was still married. So the relationship kind of ended when she grew a conscience about it. I was going on a church mission about Valentine's Day a while back, and she called me up and she wanted to come and visit before I left to go to New Orleans. We kind of rekindled whatever. I was gone in New Orleans for a week. When I came back, we started our relationship again. I was at work one day. She told me that she had something she wanted to tell me, but not over the phone and not at work. A couple days went by. She didn't have the opportunity. I walked up to her one day and said, "I'm going to say the craziest thing I could possibly say to you right now." I said, "You're pregnant, aren't you?" Her face turned beet red. She walked away. She didn't really say anything. And then a few hours later, she walked up to me. She said, "How do you know?" I said, "I didn't. I just kind of took a guess." I guess on Valentine's Day, she said she got drunk, had sex with her husband, something like that. you know, and then 10 days later, she kind of drops back into my life, and you know, we kind of start doing what we're doing, you know, and I pretty much knew that it wasn't my child. I'm kind of a safety type person, so I would take precautions. You know, it turned out that it was his kid. Right around the time she was about to give birth to that child, I had started receiving settlement checks from a car accident that I was in. And with my head being in a bad place and not really talking to anybody about it, I relapsed. I was revocated, sent to prison again. The last time I was in prison, I started changing my life around. While I was there, I started doing correspondence courses. I got certified as a personal trainer. You know, since then, I've also been certified as a nutritionist. It took me about 6 months of really trying to get a job once I got out of prison, because the felonies on my record, nobody really likes to see that. Things are working out good now with work. It still only amounts to about part-time work. But, you know, I'm working on that. Things are going good. My program is going good. I'm going to get into the solution now. I'm going to get into recovery. You know, I had mentioned the word surrender before. These are cards that I read from meditation books. I've been reading a lot of meditation books. I've been talking to a lot of people lately. You know, as Jamie had mentioned, the H&I bash last year. When I got home from that H&I bash, I found out that my paternal grandfather had passed away. I really wasn't thinking about using. I didn't have any inclinations to use. But I knew the right thing to do would be pick up the phone and call somebody and talk about it. So I picked up the phone and I called Tammy and we talked. You know, and I appreciate that a lot. You know, it meant a lot to me. Because that was really the first day that I kind of started opening up to people, you know. But I'm going to read this. Genuine surrender says, if this problem, pain, sickness, or circumstance is needed to fulfill the purpose of my higher power in my life or in another's, please don't take it away. Surrender is hard work. It's intense warfare against our self-centered nature. You know, and some of this stuff really starts to speak to humility. You know, and the word humility is in this big book everywhere. It's all over. It's in all of the readings. I'm just going to keep going with these for a little while because I know I've been talking for a while. Self-importance, smugness, and stubborn pride destroy fellowship faster than anything else. You know, principles before personalities. That's a huge part of this program for me. And when I did my four-step, you know, I have this notebook here, and this has got so much stuff in recovery. It's got everything from the definition of insanity to the definition of sanity. It has my fourth step in it. It's got all kinds of thoughts and stuff that I write down. Like, this is my recovery notebook, and it's got a lot of good stuff in there for me. Pride builds walls between people. Humility builds bridges. You know, humility is basically thinking of others. You know, the other things that I'm really getting out of this program is patience. You know, patience is developed in circumstances which we're forced to wait and are tempted to be angry or have a short fuse. And then this is something that I'm just going to speak on. You can't claim to be good if you've never been tempted to be bad. You can't claim to be faithful if you've never had the opportunity to be unfaithful. Integrity is built by defeating the temptation to be dishonest. Humility grows when we refuse to be prideful, and endurance develops every time you reject temptation to give up. You know, some of these cards are really good. I really would like to read a few more of them. I'm going to read one about forgiveness. Forgiveness is letting go of the past. Trust has to do with future behavior. Forgiveness must be immediate, whether or not a person asks for it. Trust must be rebuilt over time. Trust requires a track record. If someone hurts you repeatedly, you are commanded by God to forgive them instantly, but you are not expected to trust them immediately, and you are not expected to continue allowing them to hurt you. They must prove they have changed over time. And that's something that I'm working on. I'm really starting to get the trust back from my family and all those other people that I've hurt. And, you know, for me, it really, really, really takes patience. You know, and then one of the other little sayings that I really like to say is, a person will experience failures, but a person isn't a failure until they give up, you know? So basically, just don't give up. One of the things that I've learned through talking to people and carrying this message is, don't repress it, confess it. Don't conceal it, reveal it. Revealing your feelings is the beginning of healing. I don't know. There's another one here that kind of speaks to vulnerability. But I'm going to go into this program real quick. My solution that I have found is in these meetings, you know, is in these groups. It's with talking with people. It's with carrying the message. Working the steps with a sponsor has made a huge difference. I mean, that was something I was never really willing to do or never really willing to try, you know. How it works, I'm going to bring this up too. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail who thoroughly followed our path. That path is working the steps with people, you know, and those steps are instrumental in, like, growing in the maturity, you know, that Jamie kind of spoke on before, like, changing. A lot of that has definitely come for me through step work. And then the traditions. You know, the reason that the reason that so many people keep coming back to these, you know, the reason I keep coming back to these rooms is because these steps work for me. These traditions work for me. These tools of recovery have been the greatest use out of anything I've learned in my life. They have made the biggest difference. The meetings, the sponsor, the telephone, which is a huge reason why I failed over and over and over and over again. I never wanted to pick up that phone and call, you know, and that was my pride getting in the way. That was me not being humble. There's so much good information in all of this literature, all of these readings, the 12 and 12, the big book of AA, you know, that's what we follow, that's what we work here. All this stuff that I used to hear when I first started coming to these meetings have taken on such greater meaning to me, you know. They weren't really, didn't carry much significance for me early in recovery. It was all just kind of lip service. But then when I was willing to turn, you know, when I was willing to do those steps, turn my will and my life over to the care of God, when I was willing to take my personal inventory, when I was willing to admit it to somebody else, when I was willing to make amends with people, when being up here speaking, carrying the message to others, a big difference in my recovery has also been through my church. I do community service for St. Vincent de Paul. I do a lot of community service for a program that's called Outreach for Hope. We raise money for inner city churches that really don't raise enough money for themselves to stay active. I do a lot of community service through my own church. I also do another 12-step program that is more religious-based, and it has made a huge difference for me. A lot of those meditations books that I read say a lot of the same stuff the big book does, but it's just a little bit more specific, and it really hits home for me. And what I've really been doing lately is trying to gain that spiritual maturity. For me, that's really where I think I've started to do some of my biggest growth is learning to mature spiritually. You know, and these readings say that this is a spiritual program, not a religious one. And I, to be honest with you, as much work as I do on that, I still struggle with it. I mean, I still do. I still have feelings of insecurity. I still have tremendous feelings of loneliness. Recently, those feelings of loneliness have, like, you know, I talk about it with people. I talk about it with my sponsor. I do these meditations. And recently, these feelings of loneliness have kind of, like, festered into sadness. And then the sadness kind of festers into anger. You know, and it's a struggle. But I keep coming back, you know, one day at a time, really. That's what it comes down to. One day at a time, using these tools, working the steps, sponsoring people, helping out anyone that I can, when I can. And the Serenity Prayer has been huge for me. You know, the Serenity Prayer really helps me balance. You know, and for me, that's really what it comes down to is balancing everything. You know, accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference between those two. Accepting what I can change and then actually making a difference when I have the opportunity. You know, to me, it really comes down, I mean, it's a simple statement, but it's not a simple concept. You know, so what I really try and do is talk to my higher power about it, be patient with it, and then take advantage of the opportunity when I have it. And I'm sure I've gone over 30 minutes. So I am really thankful and grateful for you guys being here. I want to wish everybody another 24 hours, and I'm going to conclude.